Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
This is True Crime Cast. I'm Jamie, as always, joined by John. What is up?
Not much, man. Glad to be back in the booth and got a pretty cool story.
Yeah, we do. You've been out of town, which is always no fun for us in our recruiting schedule. So I'm glad you're back.
Hope recruiting? You had a, are we like we finding some college athletes?
We need to get in the game, man. We're way behind on NIL. I feel like we can sponsor some players at our local junior community college.
I don't even know if we could afford that right now because NIL is like millions of dollars. It's insane.
It is wild.
But we kind of are talking about athletes today. So
we are.
I don't know if that was an intentional segue, but
I accidentally said recruited instead of recorded. So I don't think that was.
You're like, I got to get there somehow. Let's mess up what I said.
I don't know. You get there how you get there. You know, it's not the journey, it's the destination. I think that's the opposite. I do want to give a thank you before we go into some reviews that came in over at Apple Podcasts. This one comes from Scott Thibodeau, my favorite crime podcast that I listen to. So thank you, Scott, for that. Would love to hear your other favorite podcasts at some point that are not crime related. This one is from Apple CK1. With so many true crime podcasts using vulgar language, True Crime Cast is so much more pleasant to listen to. I also enjoy their 10-minute episodes. Keep up the great work. So thank you, Apple CK1.
Is CK1 the cologne you used to wear in high school?
Calvin Klein? I don't know.
I remember that was a big deal. I don't know if it's cologne or perfume, but I remember people having it.
Yeah, I remember. I think it was a little bit of both. It was some clothes. It's what Marty McFly wore in his underpants in Back to the Future.
He did. He
did indeed. That's a great segue, though, I think.
Also want to say that it's never too late to join us over on Patreon. For as little as $3 a month, you get access to all of our bonus content. We put out a brand new exclusive episode at the beginning of every month, and we put all of our main feed on there as well, early and ad-free.
Yep, it's good stuff. So check that out if you haven't already. A lot of different ways to get involved. We appreciate all of the support.
All right. We are going to be talking about a professional boxer, and that makes me happy.
Yeah, and it's not Mike Tyson. It's not, you know, probably anybody you've ever heard of. And it was nobody I'd heard of from boxing, at least.
Yeah, we could do like a whole series of professional boxers who have gotten in some legal trouble. But today we're going to be talking about Tim Anderson. So Jamie, why don't you get the ball rolling?
Yeah. The Tim Anderson I know played for the White Sox and was a baseball player. So to me, this was a bit of a mind shift of figuring out that this was a different guy. And it is Tim Anderson we're talking about always wanted to be an athlete like so many little boys do. He was born in Chicago in 1958, and he was one of three kids. Tim was blonde, handsome, and sweet-natured by all accounts. John, you're two of those. Won't say which two.
I don't know that I'm even two. Maybe just one.
He lived with Crohn's disease, which meant that he had to eat a special diet to control his stomach problems. So this is a big deal for Tim. It's not just that his stomach hurt. It's not just that he had to go to the bathroom a lot. Like, he was wearing diapers like late into his early life. And it's quite embarrassing for a kid. So he had real struggles with this stomach disease.
I've known a few people that have this recently, and it can be really bad.
Yeah. So it's debilitating at times for sure. But he tried to stick to his diet. He tried to live the right way. And then something big in his life happened. His little sister, Erin, had an accident, and it put her in a wheelchair for the rest of her life. This happened when he was 18. And, you know, we talk about trauma often. A lot of times we're talking about these criminals whose lives are changed by being abused or accidents or both. And, I mean, The trauma of a close family member can certainly be your trauma as well. Tim spent a lot of his time protecting, defending, supporting, and helping Erin even before she was hurt, but that really picked up after she was injured as well.
Tim was an excellent baseball player. He didn't play for the White Sox, but he was good enough to sign with the Cubs out of college, and he was pitching for one of their A teams down in South Florida. When he had to have elbow surgery, however, this really derailed his baseball career. He was known for his fastball, and after that elbow surgery, you're just not going to be able to do that anymore.
And this was in the 70s, so now he would probably come back and be just fine, but in the 70s, that's it.
Is that surgery called Tommy John's?
Is
that a different?
No, that is an elbow surgery specifically for your UCL. Not exactly sure what was wrong with him because they didn't call it that then, if that's what it was. But yeah, there was a time when that was like you'll never be the same. You're going to be out for over a year. Now it's kind of a routine thing, kind of like an ACL that used to be such a long recovery. And it's still not fun, but it's much faster now. Yep. All that to say that if this happened today, he would have probably come back to baseball and been just fine.
Well, and he still, I do want to be clear because I probably made that sound confusing. He still played for the A team down in South Florida. But I don't think it was ever what it could have been, if that
right.
makes sense.
Oh, yeah. He didn't. His career stalled, even though he didn't have to quit completely.
He had a degree in, I want to say, kinesiology, which is the...
Kinesiology?
Kinesiology, the study of human movement, which is blending anatomy and physiology, the biomechanics to improve health, performance, and rehabilitation. And this earned him the nickname of Doc, which is a great nickname.
It is a great nickname. He wasn't necessarily a doctor, but he knew a lot about sports injuries.
You know, I helped you with your feet. You can reference an episode of Bless Their Hearts. So if you just want to start calling me Doc, I'll take it.
I can do that. No, I mean, you made a big impact on my life.
In so many ways.
Every time I take a step, positive. I think of you.
To make ends meet, Tim worked security at Hollandale, which Hollandale Beach Ballroom. That's where he met Jim Murphy. So when he met Jim, the two became roommates and best friends. You know, it's one of those times in your life where you meet somebody and you just click.
So security at a ballroom is a fancy way to say that he was pretty much a bouncer.
Yeah.
He was there because he was big and strong, and he was a scary looking dude, and he had been boxing since high school.
This guy's doing it all.
When you were in high school, like, did you have an opportunity to box? This is
not
like I hear about this. Is that a thing?
We would bring
anywhere in America.
There would be some guys in football who would bring boxing gloves to football practice, and we would box. And by we, I mean everybody but me, because I was a pansy. But no, there was no like real opportunity to be a boxer.
Yeah, same here. So that always is intriguing to me. But he did have that opportunity. He really liked the discipline that the sport of boxing brought to him, and he had actually won 3 Golden Glove competitions. And there's a Golden Glove in baseball, but I imagine winning one in boxing is just as difficult, because for boxing you had to control your diet, you had to stay in shape, you had to stay on top of things all the time. Part of boxing is enduring pain, which is part of Crohn's disease. So in a lot of ways, the skills that his disease built up helped him in boxing. And when the Cubs organization found out that he was boxing on the side, they told him that he was going to have to choose. So we're not going to have you go get hurt while you're boxing while we're paying you to play baseball, which minor league baseball players really don't make that much money anyway, but... Essentially, this is him deciding, am I going to trade baseball for boxing for a potential career? And he chose boxing, and he turned pro in 1983. This was in his late 20s, and that's when he met a man named Rick Parker. Rick's nickname was Elvis. He was a quick-talking, slick, convincing promoter. When I think of Rick Elvis Parker, I think of the word greasy, slimy, like, I don't know, like a con man is the vibe that I get from him.
I'm trying, like, there's so many images that come to my mind from like WWF back in the day when you would have I guess it was a promoter or an agent, and they were just, yeah, they were like this. But this guy's doing this in real life.
Yeah, real life. Not a persona, not a gimmick. Journalist Jack Newfield described Parker as the missing link between boxing and professional wrestling. So that's
okay. Well, that's where maybe I'm getting that image from.
No. I think it hits close to home because his personality was bigger than real life. And I don't mean that in a good way. Like, it wasn't like he didn't light up a room. Let's say it that way. But you knew he was there. He was from Missouri. He was a bigger dude. He wore a red hairpiece and he spoke with a southern accent and a lisp.
I think I'm nailing this list more than the other one you mentioned earlier.
I didn't want to say anything, but it's pretty close. But these are not things I would expect from somebody who tries to be out in the public, like wearing a hairpiece and, yeah, not very well spoken, but he did that. And he tried to talk like Elvis, which was part of the nickname as well. But he was a character for sure, and he connected with Tim when he went pro in boxing.
Well, he initially made his money selling cleaning supplies, and he would use his earnings to try to be like a rock concert promoter. One day, though, he was on a flight, and that's when he met arguably the greatest boxing promoter of all time, Don King. Man, growing up in the 90s, like, everybody knew the name Don King. You know, like, I don't know, he's one of those cultural icons, maybe.
Yeah, even if you didn't get involved in boxing, you knew the reference, you knew loud, over the top. I mean, a lot of the things that we've described Parker as, but I never thought of Don King as sleazy, maybe greedy, maybe...
I just remember
arrogance.
The hair.
Yeah, yeah, it was
hair,
tall.
Like the
it
troll
tall.
Hair.
Yeah.
King, on that flight, told Parker that boxing was where he could make real money, especially if he could find, quote, the great white hope, specifically a heavyweight. So at the time, black Americans were dominating the boxing world. I mean, think about it. You've got Mike Tyson, Holyfield, Foreman.
And you're coming out of Ali and Frazier and Sugar Ray Leonard. Like, this is, yeah, I mean, I named zero white dudes. So it was dominated then really by African-American athletes.
So King thought that if he could find the great white hope, then maybe that would draw some, you know, draw in a bigger crowd. I mean, it's not something that was said publicly, I don't think, but I'm wondering if he was thinking that, you know, if you could get a heavyweight battle between, you know, a black guy and a white guy in the early 90s, that could draw a crowd.
Absolutely, you know? Yeah.
That's just speculation. But Parker started looking for the new great white hope, and he needed money because he had a very expensive home in Orlando, and he was doing mountains of coke every single day.
Coca-Cola?
No, cocaine.
Yeah, it's an expensive, horrible, horrible habit, but he wanted to keep it going and had to find ways to pay for it. So Parker and Tim Anderson went to dinner where Parker charmed Tim into letting him be his promoter. They made a deal where they could split everything down the middle. John, there's a new documentary out about boy bands, and we covered the story of Lou Pearlman and all the awful things he did to teenage boys and stealing their money and the horrible deals they got into. So I don't know. It's on top of my mind that a lot of these contracts between agents and promoter, like, especially before you get to 2010, I feel like things are maybe more regulated now. I don't know, but I feel like Tim's getting ripped off here. It's a long way to say that.
Well, really, because I mean, they offered to split everything down the middle. So you think Tim should get more than Parker?
He's the one getting punched in the face.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess you're right. But he wouldn't get punched in the face on live TV without.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's certainly
maybe 80-20 would be better.
Yeah. I could get down with that. I think that's more standard.
I think the NIL agents are getting like 3% or less.
Yeah.
But it's 3% of millions. So
I should take a lesson from Elvis Parker, I guess. But he set up a fight between Tim and the aforementioned George Foreman on November 21st, 1987 in Orlando in a match that would be televised across the state of Florida. Quick aside, I met George Foreman once at an event.
That's awesome.
It was super cool. I got to take a picture with him and talk to him. And I spent so long thinking, what am I going to say to George Foreman?
This could be so many different things you were at. It could be a sports-related convention. It could be a food-related convention, because I know you love the George Foreman grill. So
yeah, no, that's a good point. It was actually an adoption.
Oh, well,
like a foster care thing.
Not on my radar.
Yeah, it was awesome. But when I finally got up there, I just said, "Hey, I like your haircut." So I totally blew it.
Is he bald?
Yeah, he's bald like me. It was a great time. Anyway, George Foreman, great fighter, seemed like a good dude. Big fan of his grill. During the lead up to this match, Tim had a flare up of his Crohn's disease where he got really sick. And when this happens, not only are you in pain, but you have trouble keeping food inside you to give you nutrients you need, especially if you're going to be performing athletically at a high level. But he didn't want to back out. This was a big opportunity. Foreman was a big deal at the time, and he wanted to give it a shot. And I don't know if the Crohn's issue actually changed the outcome. I think he very well may have lost anyway, but he was dominated and got knocked out in the fourth round. But he did earn some respect because he kept getting up when George Foreman knocked him down, which is a lot more than I would do. He showed that he was tough and that he could potentially compete at that level. This is one of his first pro boxing contests, so it was a big deal. Even George Foreman said, "I didn't get that much action out of Joe Frazier."
Dang.
Man, I tell you, I miss that era of boxing. There was so much trash talk.
Also,
I couldn't tell you a single boxer right now.
What a heck of a way to get introduced into the professional boxing world. Hey, you're going to go fight arguably one of the best boxers of all time.
Yep.
Good luck.
Yeah, one day he's going to have a grill. I know you don't know this, but it's going to revolutionize.
He's going to revolutionize the way you can make bacon in the morning.
Which is not great for his Crohn's disease, so I feel like...
Or Michael Scott's foot.
I feel like George Foreman really wrecked Doc Anderson in a number of ways. But this established him as potentially a solid boxer. It really set him up for a decent career, and he and Foreman struck up a relationship, so... Seems like the start of something beautiful, but if this was a happy story, we probably wouldn't be here. So we'll be right back for the rest of it on True Crime Cast.
Switching gears over to Parker, whether his fighter would win or lose, it didn't matter. He was going to party after every fight. So they would go back to his hotel room. He would take out his keyboard and he would sing and kind of be the entertainment. His bodyguard said that it was cocaine, Crown Royal, and Neil Diamond. I'm okay with Neil Diamond, but if you got to go listen to the same five Neil Diamond songs every night, played five times each, I mean, it gets kind of sad, end quote.
I didn't know if that was your quote or his till halfway through it, so that was pretty fantastic.
Well, I mean, I wholeheartedly agree with the bodyguard. Even Neil Diamond performing Neil Diamond, not on my to-do list.
Neil Diamond, Crown Royal, and cocaine, Breakfast of Champions.
Yeah, to be clear, I'm not a fan of any of those things, but especially Neil Diamond.
Yeah, no, totally get it, totally get it.
No, the drug use really started wearing on Tim. He never drank. He never did any drugs. He thought the drugs were corrupting Parker's decision-making, and I find that to be a reasonable thing to think. Parker was supposed to be 50-50 with Tim, but Parker was keeping most of the money for safekeeping, you know?
Man.
You know, you don't want anything to happen to Tim's money, so why not invest it in cocaine?
Right. It's the gold of the 90s. I don't know. We talk about lawyering up quite a bit if you're in a legal pickle or you're accused of something, but I don't know. You should just always have a lawyer with you all the time. It would fix a lot of problems like this for Tim. Eventually he got fed up though and he left Parker. But when he did so, like you said earlier, you're not getting the opportunities that you got before, so money was tight. He ended up moving back in with a guy named Jim Murphy, and they did the math and realized that Parker actually owed Tim from all of their dealings together. Again, he had been keeping money for that quote-unquote safekeeping. He owed Tim $173,000.
That's the equivalent to almost $500,000 in today's money.
Oh, wow. Did you, like, I just saw the math face come across your face there.
Well, I Googled it.
Yeah, I get it. I was trying to give you some credit. Yeah, that's $173,000 now, still a lot of money. But
absolutely.
Somebody owed you $500,000. That's not something you're just going to forget about and moved on.
Back in the 90s, you could buy at least 30 houses with that kind of money.
Oh, at least. That's, man, that's insane. So he wanted the money, obviously, and he needed the money, and, you know, for himself, but also his sister. Remember, she's in a wheelchair and he's kind of dedicated to taking care of her. And Parker said, yep, you know, I realize I owe you this money and I'm going to get it to you. And after Tim left him, Parker thought that he had finally found his great white hope in a guy named Mark Gastineau. Gastineau, you may have heard that name before, was a retired NFL player, or a former NFL player, I should say, for the New York Jets. He was a tall, good-looking dude. He already had name recognition from being in the NFL. So Parker thought that Gastineau was going to be his golden goose. And if you ever saw this guy in the news, it probably wasn't for sports. He dated Sylvester Stallone's ex-wife, Bridget Nielsen. And he tried to be one of those athletes that wanted to be larger than the sport and become a part of pop culture. So he did leave football in 91 and decided to become a boxer and signed with Parker. He worked and trained hard. He wanted to really do this, to make an effort to be not only a professional boxer, but a successful one. Parker worked with him and told people that he had secured an informal agreement from George Foreman's manager, Ron Weathers, that he would get to fight George Foreman as well. Weathers said that if Gastineau could get to a 12-0 record, that he could have a fight against George Foreman. Now, Weathers denies any of this ever happened. He says it's pure BS. You couldn't have sold Gastineau to Foreman in 1,000 years. There's no way Foreman would agree to this, what he thought was kind of a gimmick match of this retired football player. And as far as we know, that was true. Foreman did not respect him as a boxer. He was a good football player and made it to the NFL. That's a big deal. But it didn't seem like he was a good boxer. He was athletic. He was strong. He was fast. But they don't call it the sweet science for nothing. Like, you have to be good at boxing, not just athletic, to be good at this.
It's a skill that, it's almost like you have to have it instinctually, because punches are coming at you fast and you got to know how to get away from it.
Yeah, the instincts and reactions. That's what it's all about.
Parker believed that if he could get him to 12-0, then he could get a multi-million dollar match. And, you know, what a dream. So he lined up easy opponents and then paid them to take dives against Gastineau. So by June of 1992, Gastineau was 9-0. Parker secured a spot for Gastineau to have a match on Tuesday Night Fights on USA, but he needed an opponent. So he needed a plausible fighter, not just the guys off the street that he had been putting up against Gastineau to get him the 9-0. So he turned to Tim Anderson. He promised to pay Tim the $173,000 owed to him plus interest if he would just fight. Whether you win or lose, you're getting that money. I did the math because I was joking about how many houses it would buy. 4.5 of the first houses that I lived in would be like, so that's a lot of money.
And you didn't start buying houses till 15 years after
that. My parents bought. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. Jim Murphy, you know, Tim's roommate, best friend, urged him not to accept, but Anderson was confident that he would win. He would get the money that he was owed.
And in case people aren't aware, boxing, you get money for showing up. So you're booked on the card. You agree to, we're getting this much of the gate, this much of TV, whatever. There is additional money for winning. So it's one of the most violent sports that exist, and it's got a guy fighting over a belt and a purse.
If you would give me $1 million to go fight Sean O'Malley, I would. I would immediately tap out. He wouldn't even touch me yet. I'd be like, tap, tap, tap.
Right. But yeah.
I would take that $1 million.
How much for you to actually take a punch?
By Sean O'Malley?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know that a million would do it.
Okay. Yeah, I get that. Like, these guys are really going after each other. I mean,
he would probably kill me.
Yeah. Probably worth it. So the Saturday before the match, Parker went to see Tim in his hotel room and showed him $500,000 in a suitcase. So if a guy owes me a bunch of money and he has a suitcase full of cash, I'm like, okay, maybe you are going to pay me. But that's not all that Parker wanted. Parker was trying to secure another win for Gastineau. He said if Tim lost on purpose, he could have the entire suitcase full of cash. So this is almost three times as much as he was going to get if he just went in and tried to win. Tim, who by all indications was a man of integrity, did not accept the offer. And he later said, I'm never going to beat George Foreman. I'm never going to beat Larry Holmes, but I'm never going to lose to Mark Gastineau.
I mean, I don't know if he's a man of integrity, and I'm not saying he's not, but just the pride of it. You know, if Gastineau is known for being just not a great boxer, you can't take that shot to the ego. You know what I mean?
I don't know, man. Money talk. If money's tight and you're worried about paying bills and somebody's offering you this much money, you got to consider it.
You know, I have enough pride and not enough brain cells to be like, I don't know, man, you know?
Yeah, we'll see how many boxing matches in before you just start falling down on purpose and start getting knocked down. But Gastineau, like you said, wasn't good, and Tim Anderson wanted that win. He was still considered a boxer. This wasn't like he had stopped boxing and was just coming back for this one match. He wanted to make a name for himself and to make himself look good. And on the night of that fight, it happened in June of 92, Gastineau was stiff, and Tim really made him look stupid. In the fourth round, Gastineau took a left hook to the chin and crumpled to the mat. He was knocked out, and the fight was over. Now, he blamed his performance on an argument he had with his girlfriend. In the background of an interview, you can see Parker just furious because he, A, needed Gastineau to win this to have a shot with Foreman or a bigger fighter. But B, he was mad at Anderson because he tried every way in the world to get Anderson to throw this, and he wouldn't do it. So Parker is lost this opportunity for Gastineau. He's lost out on millions of potential earnings. So now he's mad at Anderson. Even though he pulled him into this, this wasn't like Anderson came to him and screwed him over. He pulled Anderson in. Anderson won. But now he wants his revenge.
Well, I mean, Parker needed Gastineau to get to 12-0 so that he could potentially fight Foreman and get the real payout. But now with this loss on Gastineau's record, even though Weathers had never actually agreed to this, in Parker's mind, it's all gone.
Right. Yeah. He thought
his cash cow is gone.
Yep.
Several months later, Parker contacted Tim about a rematch. He said that Gastineau was costing him too much money because he was paying Gastineau $5,000 a fight and all of his expenses, which seems low, but I guess you haven't really had that breakout match yet.
Right.
Parker told Tim that if Gastineau lost two fights, he would cancel the contract. But believe it or not, Parker still hadn't paid Tim the $173,000 that he owed him. But he said if he beat Gastineau one more time, he'd pay him everything that he was owed. If I saw a suitcase full of money the night that I beat Gastineau and I didn't walk away with half of that suitcase, I'm mad.
Yeah.
I'm not taking any more of your calls.
Yeah. I'm not negotiating with you. We're not friends. We're not business partners anymore. You're now my enemy.
Tim thought about it. He discussed it with his friend, Jim Murphy, and his dad. Murphy said, this thing stinks to high heaven. I mean, how many times are you going to let this guy screw you over? Basically, that was not a quote by Murphy. That was John Boy. Tim needed the money, though, and it felt like a sure thing, so he agreed. Murphy remembers telling Tim, quote, whatever you do, don't eat anything, don't drink anything, don't hang out around those people, end quote. The match was set for Oklahoma. This was in December of 1992. because Oklahoma didn't have a boxing commission at the time, it was a place for an event to be forgotten. There were only 200 people or so that were there. It was not televised, but someone was filming in the audience.
Yeah, and a boxing commission basically sanctions it. They help promote it. It's that's why a lot of fights happen in Vegas. That's and the commission can license fighters. They can revoke their licenses to box and compete in certain states. Like, it's a big deal. So saying that isn't just a lot of people don't box in Oklahoma. I'm sure people in Oklahoma punch each other all the time. So this was a big deal that it wasn't in a sanctioned state. Makes it super questionable, in my opinion. I don't know why you would spend a lot of time fighting in those areas when it's not going to be, at this point, he's not going to be seen by anybody. So I'm not sure, besides revenge, what Parker was even after here. So when Tim went to fly to Oklahoma, it was discovered that his handlers didn't have tickets. So they weren't going to be able to get into the event. And it's important because his handlers are the ones that take care of him. They get him in there. They get him everything he needs. He's in there getting taped up.
These are people you would know and trust.
Right. And they do so much for you. Like a boxer, your job is to fight. Everybody else is there to get you suited up, to get you to the right place, and to get you ready to go. And he needed those people. But he went out there anyway, where Parker provided his own people to look after Tim. The amount of trust that Tim continues to put in Parker after getting screwed over time and again is, he may be a better man, more forgiving than me. But before the match, Tim, who's in his early 30s at this time, was given a cup of water to drink. And remember, his roommate had said, don't spend time with Parker's people. Don't take anything from them or put anything in your body. He took a cup of water and he asked for a water bottle. But his corner man, so again, one of the handlers provided by Parker, said, I can't find your water bottle. You're going to have to drink it from this cup, which, I mean, is super shady sounding in retrospect. I'm certain at the time that Tim just thought, well, I mean, these are professionals. They're here to help me. I'm just going to take a drink of this water. I'm really thirsty. He said it tasted sweet, and he told Parker that he didn't like it. He never put sugar in his water. I mean, boxers do some wild things with the things they put in their body, but he said he's never put sugar in it. He doesn't add anything to his water. He didn't like that. Parker told him it was fine. Just drink it. You're thirsty. We'll get you out ready to fight. But 45 minutes later, when Tim went out to fight, the match did not go as expected. Tim obviously was not himself. He wasn't moving around like normal. He seemed to have a hard time seeing. You could tell he was squinting, rubbing his eyes a lot. He just was not himself. Something was wrong here. He described it as being in kind of a daze, almost as if like an out-of-body experience. He said he was actually hallucinating that there were monkeys in the ring with them. And he screamed at the ref to get the monkeys out of there.
Is it not like automatically cancel that fight? I mean, if you genuinely cared about people.
Well, let me say again, this is an unsanctioned state. And I'm not saying this referee was not legit. But if I'm there to officiate and keep the fighter safe and boxing within the rules, and one claims he's seeing monkeys, we're kind of done. Because I think that threatens the safety of both of them, right?
Yeah, but at the same time, like you said, it was not sanctioned. And this is your main, like if you have a card, this is your main ticket. This is your main event.
Yep, this was the main event. And it ended with Gastineau knocking Tim out in the sixth round and getting the win. Again, Gastineau is not a good boxer. So for him to...
It would take six rounds for him to beat a drugged Anderson.
I mean, he was running pretty fast from those monkeys. No, it was... So obviously for it to take him that long, it shows how bad he was at actual boxing. But Tim was not himself. So something was in that water.
Yeah, after the bell rang, someone in the crowd yelled that Tim needed a doctor, and there was a ringside physician that came and would examine him. And the physician said something wasn't right, and they needed to take Tim to the hospital immediately. But Rick stepped in. He said no, they would take care of him. It would be fine. They took Tim to the dressing room where he constantly vomited. Eventually, everyone left. Parker even left, locked up the place behind him, and this would leave Tim alone, covered in vomit. Thank the good Lord, at 3 a.m., there was a janitor that came in. He found Tim and called an ambulance. If that janitor had not come in to clean everything up that evening and would have waited until Monday, Tim would have likely died. The following months for Tim were filled with nausea, dizziness, more vomiting. He was bedridden and taken to multiple doctors who were saying that he was poisoned, but they could not determine what kind of poison it was. Toxicologists said that it could have been any kind of toxic metal, such as mercury, or even a little bit of cyanide, which is what my first thought was when he described the drink as being sweet.
Right. I think that's a pretty common, I don't know, description of what that would taste like. And to be clear, Parker left him for dead. He's laying there in his own vomit in the back, and he, I guess, is hoping that he dies there and he can say, oh, well, he was always sick. He had Crohn's. This is not in any way resembling what Crohn's would do for you. Tim couldn't work for over a year. I mean, he was fighting for survival there for a little while. So he was in really, really bad shape. But when he did start working again, he started working as a personal trainer. And on the side, he was working on a book about the boxing world. He was going to call it Liars, Cheats, and Whores.
Thoughts? Another list that describes me.
Right? This is the book of John. The liars were the promoters, the cheats were the managers, and the whores were the fighters. So making some analogies here about the boxing world and the way things work out practically when looking at everything. So certainly a very opinion-laden book was what he was trying to get going here. This was along the same time that Congress was looking into the boxing world and zeroing in on Parker's activities. And obviously Parker didn't want this book to come out because he was of the cheats and the liars. He was the cheatingest, lyingest one of them. So he didn't want this to come out, especially since he had tried to kill Tim for all intents and purposes. Later that same year, Tim was walking to his car when something struck him in the back and knocked him to the ground. He then had a man standing over him talking to him that said, "You need to forget everything to do with Rick Parker." And then he showed him a picture of his sister and her daughters on their front porch. So basically they're saying, we know you're writing this book. We know you're speaking out against people like Parker, specifically about Parker's activities. Cut it out or we're coming after your family. And Tim got that message. I mean, this isn't beating around the bush. This is a pretty clear indication of what they're threatening him with.
In the winter of 1994, a toxicologist told Tim that if he didn't find out what he was poisoned by, he could die. So I guess he had ongoing effects and was really struggling. So Tim had to get a hold of Parker. And at this point, Parker had been driven out of boxing because of his fight fixing and the FBI were investigating him. So Tim decided to get in touch with Parker's sister, Diane, and tell her that he needed to see Parker about this poisoning, and if he didn't, he was going to die. So Diane felt bad for him, and she arranged a meeting for the two men to meet in Orlando, Florida. Before going there, Tim's friend, again Jim Murphy, said Tim was going to need a gun for protection because he knew Parker was typically armed, and he did not expect this meeting to go well. So Jim took Tim to a gun store in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and helped him pick out a gun. He bought a .38 Special 5-shot revolver.
It's a pretty nice gun.
Yeah, I'd love to have one of those.
On April 28th, 1995, Diane drove Tim and Parker's 14-year-old son, who he hadn't seen in several years, to the Embassy Suites Hotel in Orlando. Tim had his gun in his waistband. As far as we know, he had no intention to go in there guns a-blazing. He took that weapon for protection. They went to Parker's room, and Diane told his son that they should let Tim and Parker talk business for a little bit. Tim turned to Parker and said, "I need to know exactly what the drugs and poison were. Otherwise, I'm going to die." Now, I'm trying to put myself in everybody's shoes here. I'm taking the John route. If I'm Parker here, I assume this is a setup. He's trying to get me to confess to poisoning him. So this is not going to sit well, I don't think. Parker danced around the topic. He didn't want to give away any incriminating information. He said he didn't know what happened and that he probably got the stuff from another handler in Texas. So he was completely trying to distance himself from it. Tim continued to try to get Parker to answer him. "Just tell me what you did. It could save my life. I have a family," all these things. Parker went to salesman mode and said he'd go to the doctor with Tim and find out what was going on with him and try to help him get it figured out. But Tim at this point, and again, I don't think he intended to go in there guns a-blazing. And sorry if that's not the right reference here. It's just what's in my head. But if you're dying and somebody has the cure to save you in front of you and they're just like, nah, like that's going to get you, right? So,
and if that wasn't the money that was owed to him had to be in the back of his mind somewhere too. But yeah, you're right. I mean, he holds the key to life or death, basically.
So he got fed up and he pulled out his gun. This enraged Parker and he screamed, "How dare you point a gun at me and threaten me like that? Just for that stunt, your sister's dead."
Remember, I mean, he had been hit by a car and showed a picture of his sister. So he knew that Parker knew his family. So that was the straw that broke the camel's back.
I also don't know that if somebody's pointing a gun at me, me threatening them is going to alleviate the situation, but I'm no Rick Parker. I always say that.
That's true. So Tim says that his mind went blank. And when he came to, Parker had been shot at least 11 times, possibly 13 times. Jamie, if you remember, the gun that he brought in was a revolver that only held 5 shots. Excellent so point. He reloaded twice. So shooting him up and down, including shots to his genital area. Tim called 911. He went back to the 39-year-old Parker and saw that he was dead. And Tim put the gun in his own mouth and pulled the trigger, but the gun jammed. So at that point, Tim walked down to the reception area and admitted that he had done everything, that he had killed Parker. So he said to Parker's sister, Diane, who again was the one who set up this meeting, he told her, "I'm sorry, I didn't mean for it to happen like this," end quote. Tim was arrested. He was placed on suicide watch at the Orange County Jail. He was charged with first-degree murder. The boxing world was not surprised that Parker was murdered, but they were surprised that he was murdered by Tim Doc Anderson.
Yeah, again, he had a good reputation, seemed to be a guy of integrity, had a good head on his shoulders, and he pretty quickly got out of business with Parker. So for most people, they're like, yeah, he gets it. But obviously, this is a situation that nobody, I don't know how anybody is going to react with their back against the wall like Anderson had. And a year later, he went on trial in Orlando. He had court-appointed attorneys who were able to get the death penalty taken off the table. And their main argument was that the shooting was in self-defense and that Tim blacked out after his sister was threatened, so should not be held accountable for what happened when he was unaware of what he was doing. They tried to show that Parker's threats were usually seen through in real life, that he had to take this threat seriously. The defense tried to paint a full picture of Parker, but were unable to use evidence of the poisoning at the trial because Parker did not have a gun on him that was ever found that day. They didn't prove that that's where he was poisoned. So for them to be able to bring that in, they had to show direct connection to what happened. So without the poison angle, without Parker being armed, the angle for self-defense really wasn't there. The state argued that the poisoning never actually happened and that Tim reloading the gun twice proved that he was aware of what was happening, enough to know what he was doing, to reload, and do it again. The trial lasted 4 days, and ultimately the jury found Tim Anderson guilty of the first-degree murder of Rick Elvis Parker. One juror was interviewed later, and she said that had she known about the poisoning and the question about it in the hotel room, and that that's why Tim was there, then she wouldn't have wanted to charge him with first-degree murder and would have found at least an argument to be made for self-defense or some type of insanity plea. At the time, the jury wrote to Judge Conrad to ask for leniency, but they didn't realize that in Florida, a first-degree murder verdict meant that he had no choice but to sentence him to life without parole. So there's no flexibility in that sentence. So the jury decided he was guilty, so he was sentenced to life without the possibility of parole.
After the trial, one of Tim's boxing buddies made a shocking discovery. So the man that took the stand, claiming to be the referee at the match in Oklahoma, testified that Tim seemed absolutely fine during the match and that he did not appear to have been poisoned. So this is why the judge did not allow any evidence from the poisoning to be submitted as part of the trial. That man was named Houston Perkins. But when Tim's friend found the lost video of the Oklahoma match, and I mentioned that earlier, key detail, he saw clearly that Houston Perkins was not the referee in the ring. In fact, Houston Perkins was a boxer who worked for Parker in Oklahoma. The referee in the ring was named Steve Thomason, who was never called as a witness and had no idea a trial was even happening. So when the friend brought Houston Perkins' perjury up to the courts, they said there was nothing that could be done about it, as a mistrial has to be called during a trial, and Tim had exhausted all of his other appeals.
We had a conversation last week with Anya and Kevin from the Murder Sheet about appeals, and it's about process, and there are limitations. You can't just appeal endlessly for the rest of your life, so there are limitations on that.
I feel like this should be like an exception.
Yeah, I would think this could come up in post-conviction relief conversations. I feel like this, I mean, this is huge, right?
Absolutely.
That somebody was lying about being the referee, and it could have changed
everything. It's a crime. I mean, yeah. This guy should be charged and held accountable for this.
In 1999, Tim had surgery on cancerous nodes in his throat, which had damaged his vocal cords and left him with a hoarse and raspy voice. To this day, Tim still doesn't know what he drank the night of the match. All appeals have been exhausted, and the only way Tim could see freedom is through clemency granted by the Florida governor. But experts say it's a long shot that Tim will ever get out. He's been in prison in Zephyrhills, Florida since 2018. While in prison, he's been a model prisoner and preaches to the other inmates. He thinks about coming out someday and opening a gym where he can tell kids about God like George Foreman had told him about God. He's 68 years old today, works out 5 days a week, and feels fitter than ever. Parker's sister Diane has completely forgiven Tim. So, my first reaction here is he didn't die from the poison. So, what doctor told him it was going to kill him if he didn't find out what it was? Because that seems to have not held up over time.
Yeah.
I don't know.
If you're in there and you think that your life is going to come to an end if he doesn't tell you, he definitely murdered the guy, but could this have been dropped down to like manslaughter because you weren't in a mental state that, you know, you didn't go in there planning? Well, I'm going to assume he did not go in there planning to kill Parker, but that's what happened when he was threatened. His sister was threatened and he was not going to get the cure that he needed. And this guy also owed him a lot of money.
He did owe him a lot of money. And this is a tough one for me. There are people out there advocating for Tim. If you would like to do so, you can reach out to the Florida governor's office, Ron DeSantis, and you can request that his case be heard by the clemency board. And we'll provide that link in the show notes of where you can send that email. I've got to tell you, John, I'm having a hard time with getting on board with this. Yes, it seems that I'm looking at facts here. Parker owed him a lot of money. It does seem like something was wrong with him in that fight. He has lived for decades since this happened. Seems to be in really good health at 68 years old. In retrospect, all we know is that guy owed him money. He went into this room and killed him. Everything else is kind of speculation hearsay.
We could never know what actually happened in that room. But if there were, you know, I know that the poisoning was not heard in court, but are there documents that show a doctor actually told him this? If that's true, then in my mind, it does change things.
Yeah, if we can find that, it does change things.
Could find the actual referee who, for whatever reason, didn't cancel the fight when he was seeing hallucinations of monkeys, then,
right.
You know, I do think that with a proper investigation and an actual trial, I think he still goes to jail, but I think the charge is different. Therefore, the sentencing would be as well.
Yeah, even the poisoning, I don't know if it, like the poisoning itself that had happened and cost him the fight, I don't know if that moves the needle at all for me. It would have to be the death sentence from the doctor that would change the situation here for me, because if he's healthy and he still goes and kills him, then I think that's first-degree murder. If he does think he's going to die and you're pointing a gun at somebody, if I'm pointing a gun at you, I don't care what you say. I don't know that it's going to make it okay for me to shoot and kill you, who you threaten. And maybe it does. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe you disagree with me here. But in my mind, unless we know that that doctor said he was going to die, I'm okay with this first degree murder charge.
Yeah, because at that point, then you're really going in there with anger in your heart because of the money. I'm curious too, like in the 90s, is there really not a way to figure out what poison was ingested? I mean, I feel like they would have had some kind of blood work that could have determined that.
Right.
Maybe I'm wrong, but just playing devil's advocate.
I mean, when he goes directly to the hospital, they're taking all kinds of blood. I imagine something had to be in there. And my assumption is when we get to the actual shooting, he's being treated for the symptoms. It's probably not in his body anymore, but if it damaged his kidneys, his liver, whatever, if they said that your kidneys are going to shut down and you're going to die, then maybe they don't know what had caused that. But you're right. He did that blood work right after. So
yeah.
I'm not as I need more information here before I start advocating for somebody to be released. And some of the facts that he presents, like I'm going to die if I don't get this answered, didn't seem to hold up.
So maybe I won't advocate for just his immediate release, but, you know, maybe do a little bit more digging and find out what information was not admitted into court and then go from there.
And I'll say this, the fact that they got the wrong guy who wasn't the referee, that's enough for a retrial. Absolutely. Say that. So you're right. I won't say let him out, but I think he deserves a retrial based on that alone. And I'm sure that means that the prosecution left some things out that they knew about. He had public defenders who could have gone to the doctor and said, did you tell him he was going to die? I don't know if anybody ever did that. They weren't allowed to bring it up at court because the poisoning was thrown out. So I need to hear more about what the doctor said about the poisoning for the charge to change. I think at minimum he deserves a retrial. And this is where the law gets sticky. I don't know why a PCR, a post-conviction relief petition, couldn't include this and be granted, but obviously we're at the point where it won't. The governor's got to move, or the clemency board here.
Yeah, it's a tough situation. I mean, at some point, you got to draw the line at some point, because if every prisoner in the United States were always offered retrials, our court systems are going to be more jammed up than they already are. But at the same time, these are people's lives, and you deserve to have the absolute most fair trial you can imagine. So it's tough. I get it.
Yeah. At this point, as far as is justice served, I don't have enough information to tell you that.
Yeah.
I don't know.
To be determined.
I don't know if justice is served for Parker, who by all accounts was a terrible dude. Doesn't mean he needs to be shot. Or was justice served for Tim here? I don't know. So yeah. I hate to end on that note, but that's kind of where we're at. This is a case that has not had a lot of coverage as part of our research. You and I go find what else is out there. there's not a lot on the true crime circuit about Doc Anderson. So we'd love to see more coverage and more attention so we can get some of these answers.
A little peek behind the scenes. We are working on an interview right now with folks working with Jamie Snow. We covered that case a couple weeks ago. We could run this by them and see if they would have any interest or know anybody that could take up this case. I think it's interesting, and I do want to see him have a fair shake at things.
He seems to be in good shape at 68, so this isn't a situation where he's too old. We just let him die. No, he's, I mean,
that's awful.
This can still be addressed for sure.
Guys, we appreciate you. Again, don't forget that if you have never joined Patreon, we'd love to have you over there. You get bonus episodes every month and all of our regular shows early and ad-free.
Yeah, we really appreciate y'all. Crime Con's coming up. They still have badges available. If you're interested, TCC10 will get you 10% off. Would love to meet you there. It is, in fact, a great, great time. Would also love to have some more reviews coming in. That really helps the algorithm, as they say. Reviews, subscriptions. So we'll read those on the show if you leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts.
We love you guys. And until next crime, this has been True Crimecast.
You've listened to True Crimecast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.